welcome to KingsCountRadioTV.com. This is another day that I'm sure you don't want to miss this broadcast. We are here today under the title The Community Beat. We're here with a wonderful citizen out of the community here, the Cumberland Ridgely, West Virginia community. And we're going to have an interview like none other today. We would like to welcome you. I am Pastor Carrie Scott, and you're going to hear a little bit from my husband, Pastor Kevin Scott, in a few minutes. But we'd like to just welcome our guest today, and he is the judge in Ridgely, West Virginia, Tom Golden. Welcome, Tom.
Thank you, Carrie. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here this morning with you all. I look forward to having a nice casual conversation. We can get some candor out there, be very transparent with respect to the municipal court system in Ridgely. And I'd like to talk just a little bit about my background in law enforcement, of which I did 30 years.
Wow. 30 years. That's awesome. So tell us a little bit about that.
I'd be happy to. It all started in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. That's where I was born and raised. I went to college at a college called Edinburgh State University up by Erie, Pennsylvania. I majored in criminal justice, but I actually started out in accounting. I'm a numbers guy. I love numbers. I think it's a definitive answer. It's inarguable. You know, 1 + 1 = 2. But as I was taking these accounting classes, I took a lot of criminal justice classes as fillers. And I wound up doing very well in the criminal justice classes, and I started slipping in the accounting classes. So I wound up changing my major to criminal justice, and I've always felt like that was my calling. So I wound up getting an internship with the Pittsburgh Police Department, and I absolutely loved it. You may have heard of the show called Hill Street Blues in the day.
Yes.
Well, I was assigned to the Hill District in Pittsburgh.
Oh, my.
And I just rode along. It was kind of like a ride along with the police officers, and I was really intrigued. I just liked the way that they operated, helping people and doing things that, you know, maybe most people wouldn't want to do or couldn't even do. So I pursued that law enforcement career, and I was fortunate enough to get hired by the United States Secret Service Uniform Division. So I moved away from Pittsburgh. Now, I'm a part of a big family. I've got 5 sisters and a brother, okay, most of which are still up in the Pittsburgh area. But I moved away, and I'm the youngest of 7. So it was a little bit difficult initially, but I get into the D.C. area, and I absolutely enjoyed working for the Secret Service. And President Reagan was a president at a particular time. But there was an incident that happened, and that was the Kiki Camarena story, and that was the Just Say No starting of that with Nancy Reagan. She was the rainbow, as we refer to her on Secure Comms. She was a nice woman. President Reagan was a nice guy. Politics aside, they were very, very nice to deal with. I didn't have much interaction with them. I was just part of the protection team with the Secret Service Uniform Division. But I remember going through their training, and I remember seeing DEA agents being trained in Glencoe, Georgia. That's where the Secret Service went initially, and then they have their own academy in Beltsville, Maryland. The Secret Service Academy is fantastic, by the way, and they do wonderful training. They do a heck of a job protecting our presidents and our dignitaries. Mm-hmm. But I saw these DEA guys, and I thought they were really hard chargers behind the scenes. And I thought, you know, that may be a better calling for me, even though the Secret Service was a good job. I enjoyed it. Yes. I thought it was very important. So I applied with the DEA. I went through their academy, which at the time was with the FBI in Quantico, Virginia. And it's a 12-week academy. And you get your assignment right at the end of the academy. They kind of lock you in. Mm-hmm. You almost can't go back to your old agency, because you pretty much left that particular department, and you got your 12 weeks in with DEA, and I get assigned Miami. So I spent 10 years in Miami. What an experience that was. It was absolutely off the charts. And I could tell you some stories. You probably say, you know, I'm not sure that's for real. And you probably would think that way. Most people do. But we did some fantastic work down there in Miami, Florida. I became a training agent. I became good at that. I got transferred to the DEA Office of Training in Quantico, Virginia. That's with the FBI Academy. I did probably 11 years there. Then I got reassigned as a commander in the streets of Washington, D.C. And that was absolutely fabulous, too. There was some good work in D.C. It was hard work. It were long hours. I enjoyed it. I finally came to that point where I thought, well, maybe it's time to think about retiring. Mm-hmm. So we bought some property in West Virginia just to get away from D.C., about 50 acres. But just as I was going to retire, there was a company in the D.C. area that had contracts, government contracts overseas. The head of the company, two of the CEOs, were retired DEA agents. They knew me. They enjoyed the work that I did. They asked if I was interested in going to Kazakhstan. So I did Kazakhstan for a whole year. And then I worked at home from the D.C. area, and I was able to travel throughout the Middle East, wow, Central Asia, and all of it was pretty much doing training.
Yes, yes.
So here I am thinking, okay, this is it for me. We will move out to West Virginia, which we did. And we thoroughly enjoyed it. I was happy. I was comfortable. I was going at my own pace. I get a call from the mayor of the Kaiser City in West Virginia. He asked me if I'm interested in training his guys.
Wow.
Hey, you know, Carrie, I'd rather do that than travel overseas. I'd rather train the guys here. And most of my training is in surveillance and utilizing informants and a little bit of undercover, not much, professionalism, ethics, and so on. So I agreed to that. Well, I go to meet with the mayor, and he goes, my question has changed. And I'm thinking, well, what could that possibly be?
Oh, my.
You know, and he goes, would you agree to be our police chief? Total shift of gears. I said, well, you're going to have to give me some time on that. And I said, give me 2 weeks to think about it. Well, within 2 days, I was ready to say yes. Mm. I spoke to every member of my family. I spoke to some of my friends, some of my colleagues. I have a particular friend. He's a former Miami Dolphin. He's in the Hall of Fame. I even called him. That's number 13. Wow. That's Dan Marino. I said, look, Danny, what do you think, you know? Because I know he dealt with a lot of pressure. And he goes, you know what, Tom? I was the quarterback, and pressure comes with the territory. Go for it. And, you know, it wasn't just his conversation with me. It was my family. So yes. It was most important. My wife. My wife actually is a retired federal agent as well. So I went back to the mayor. I said, yes, I'll do it. So I did it for 2 years. And there was one day. It was a defining moment. I was down at my pond. I was fishing. And I came back from fishing, and I told my wife, I said, hey, I should fish more. And she goes, why don't you? And it was then that I thought to myself, maybe my law enforcement career could come to an end. Okay. So I went in and I spoke to the mayor, Damon Tillman in Kaiser. He's still there, good guy. And we had a conversation. I said, look, I think it's time for me to move on. Let somebody else do these tasks. And he said, no problem. So I left the particular police job. 2-3 months go by, I get a call from Ridgely.
Wow.
And it's the mayor of Ridgely, Bill Shepard, great guy. And the guys over there in Ridgely are very good. He calls me up. He says, hey, we need a judge. Would you mind coming in and interviewing for this judge position? And this was 2 years ago.
Wow.
And I was like that too, Carrie. I was like, wow. I tell my wife, she goes, really? I said, yeah. They gave me a call. Yeah, I like challenges. I'm that type of a guy. It's like doing this and how we met. And coming out here and having a conversation with you guys. I get myself into situations that are challenging. I kind of like the pressure. I kind of operate under that type of a domain. So I go and meet the mayor. Talks to me for about 15 minutes. He says, look, we'd love to have you. So for the past 2 years, I've been the judge. And it just doesn't come on a stroke of pen. I've had to go through training for the DEA Academy, the Secret Service Academy. I had to go through some training to become police chief through the West Virginia State Police Academy. Become a judge. I had to go through the municipal court training in Morgantown for that. So I'm glad that they do that. I was a guy that gave a lot of training. Mm-hmm. I enjoy getting a lot
of
training.
Absolutely. We can all do that.
So that's it, though. That's where I'm at right now with you guys.
Awesome.
Let me ask, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, or morning, wherever you are listening around the world. I'm Pastor Kevin T. Scott, and you're hearing Judge Tom Golden. Now, what's fascinating about having a judge in the studio is that you get to ask those questions.
Yes.
You all know what questions I'm talking about. How does a judge judge? What makes your judgment sound? And even though we say judge, there's still guidelines from the training and different things that you've had to learn over the years. So how does a judge judge a situation that has some complexities, but yet you have to stick to the facts and the letter of the law?
Boy, Kevin, you almost answered the question with what you just said at the end of your question. And I'm convinced in order to be a good judge, you have to be a good listener. You have to be able to understand the totality of the circumstance from when the officer or what the incident was to the completion. And being a good listener, I'm able to digest and able to factor in all the facts, like you said. I have to have the letter of the law, and I usually have that book right in front of me, just in case I forget something. So I listen to the parties involved, I listen to the law enforcement officials, and I make a decision based upon the facts. Mm-hmm. We're not there to bander back and forth. I want the facts. I establish that from the onset of the conversation. I digest those facts. I may write a note or two down. And then we make a prudent decision that's just. And I try to be as fair as possible. Now, people make mistakes. We all make mistakes.
Yes, we do.
And to me, it's what did you do as a result of that mistake? I mean, for instance, there are some folks that may come into the courtroom, and this is municipal court, it's mostly traffic court, and they'll come in, and they may have forgot to register their vehicle in time, or maybe get their car inspected in time.
Don't we know about that?
Yeah. And that's how we all met, and I thought you guys presented yourselves extraordinarily professional. You articulated your point, and I made the decision, hey, you know what, we all were down that road, I've been down that road, and we dismissed that particular charge. Mm-hmm. But you just want to be a good listener. You got to know the law. And I go through all this training. I read the book. Prior to all my cases, I get the docket pretty much a couple days ahead of time. So I'm able to research the actual citation or the law involved. And then I wait for the parties to come in, and then I listen.
Okay.
And I like to make a decision so that we're done. We can come to a conclusion. Most people are very anxious when they come in. They're not sure how it's going to go. They don't know the system.
Yes.
And I'm pretty much, hey, we're going to be done in maybe 5-10 minutes. I want to make sure we take our time. Mm-hmm. And that everybody leaves satisfied.
We're going to give the background story on this. You know, my wife and I are very particular about the law. Following it is necessary because we are pastors. We have to be examples. That's just the truth if you want to be good pastors. Long story short, I'm driving down the street and this police car pulls me over and he says, your tag is expired. And I'm from Washington, D.C. And usually you get something in the mail that tells you that your tag is about to expire. Well, not only was my tag expired, but my inspection ticket was expired as well. And I'm thinking, gosh, I follow the law. And a lot of people think that way. I'm following the law. And here you have a siren behind you. And you say, well, what do I do? Well, again, long story short, he pulls me over. And all this is a revelation to me because I'm like, I never received anything. And I immediately called my wife. Of course, I didn't get her immediately. So I stopped panicking. I stopped panicking. I said, why isn't she picking up her phone? I'm in trouble. Because you feel like you're in trouble. Well, the officer was so professional. He understood. He wrote me the citation. And we're sitting in the chambers waiting for our case to come up. And in waiting, people were coming out. Well, we had to pay $600. We had to pay $700. And people just thinking, wow, I don't have $700. How am I going to pay that? And I'm like, okay, honey, we're going to have to brace ourselves. Well, we go in and talk to this kind judge and we explain. And thankfully, because you're telling the truth, it is the truth. And when you ask a person, how do they judge? They can see the truth. It's a feeling. Maybe it's something in your bosom, but you feel it. And it was a miracle after that. Now, on the other side of that coin, I thought it was because of my wife's pretty face. That's why I brought her.
Not at all. Judge has a beautiful wife, so he wasn't concerned about that. But you know, I have to piggyback on what Kevin was saying is that with Judge Golden when we went in there. He was so professional and
yes.
You could just feel the kindness, and I just felt like he was real, not like some of the judges that you see on TV. Sometimes we have an expectation based on something we've seen on television, But I just kind of stated the facts and backed my husband up for the fact that we were really trying to, we just weren't aware that what had expired with our tags and registration, that it was so. And so, and then after that, we expeditiously got it done. I was just telling the judge a few minutes ago before we went on the air that it made us really think when it came time to making sure that the registration and tags and all that were taken care of and making sure that was handled. But, very kind and very amiable. And I love that because we always have to remember that, hey, if I was in that situation, what would happen? And I think that's what he thought about, that he's been in a situation like that. And so he's real.
And that's the experience. Now, in other traffic matters, can you give us a description of a horrific case where you wanted to be more lenient, but the law just didn't allow it?
There's several instances like that. When I was chief, if I did a traffic stop, first of all, you have to have that probable cause, whether it's speeding or a dead tag or not a registration or maybe a cell phone violation or whatnot. But there are certain instances where your hands are tied because of the law. And I think a lot of people look at the police as we're the folks that write the law, enforce the law, and we're the jury and all that jazz. That's not the case at all. We just enforce the laws that are written by quite capable people within the judicial and the legislative branch of the government. I mean, we're obviously on the executive side of the government. But there was a couple stops that I've made that, if you don't have insurance, and that's huge in any state, but it's ginormous here in the state of West Virginia, because imagine, if you're driving around with no insurance, you have an accident, and God forbid if it's a fatality, it's going to be a total mess. So let's say, for example, you're driving down the road and you get stopped because you don't have a tag or you're on the cell phone. And the officer approaches the vehicle, whether it's a he or she. Always be professional. And like you said, always be honest and truthful. When you tell the truth, there is less to remember. I cannot tell you how many times people will change their stories because obviously they're lying. They can't remember what they first said because it's not the truth. So anyway, the officer will approach, have safety mechanisms in choice, and so on and so forth. They'll ask, your license, your registration, proof of insurance. Mm-hmm. If you don't have insurance, that's an automatic tow. You can't let somebody leave that particular scene uninsured, because if they do have an accident, it's going to come back on the officer, and why did he let them leave the scene?
Wow.
Okay.
So there's certain aspects that you just got to stop and do what the law says you have to do. There's certain instances, let's say you're speeding, you're doing 55 and a 35. There could be some flexibility there. There could be a verbal warning. There could be a written warning. And you could be on your way. We've all been in situations like that. I've been stopped like that. But there are certain instances where no matter how good and how kind and how great the situation is, the officer has to do what is mandated by the rule of law.
Yes.
And that's unfortunate at times because some people tend to forget and others just lack of judgment. And that happens, Kevin, quite a few times here in Ridgely when I was in Kaiser. And unfortunately now you got a tow bill, you got to find transportation, and it's a huge wake-up call. But
absolutely,
it does prevent people from driving without insurance. Yes. And that's a big one here in the state of West Virginia. That's huge.
Yeah.
Well, insurance. We're just involved in a situation. This is up close and personal. These are real incidents, and we have a judge here to give us an idea and a snapshot of the processes that you have to go through. My car was parked out right in front of the studio, and this gentleman backed into it. I'm not in the car. I saw him back into it. I heard him when he hit it, and he says, "Well, I didn't do that damage." And I'm like, "Wait a minute, I just saw you hit it. I heard the crash. So you admit to hitting it. Now you're going to tell me what damage you did or didn't do? That doesn't make sense to me." So when a judge hears that, because eventually it's going to get to that point, what would they think? How would they process that information?
Well, first of all, the investigative officer, I would hope he would do a thorough report. The report's going to be critical with respects to the court proceedings. Maybe there's a camera out front. Hopefully they would look into something like that. Your statements will be critical as well, because It's basically a misdemeanor outside the purview of law enforcement. And that's why you go to court on those. And that's why we have no-fault insurance, too, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Because in these instances where it's like he said, she said, sometimes, right. You know, you throw the flag and the insurance companies just pick up the bill. But it's a personal thing. It's a pride thing. It's an honesty thing. And I see where you're coming from that. And we get a few cases like that, that I will make a judgment based upon, you know, the facts I hear.
Mm-hmm.
In some instances, you'll be surprised at what the other party will say. They'll be think they're totally innocent. And I'll tell you an example. I get a lot of cases where folks, their driver's license expired. And they'll mm-hmm. they will say, well, I didn't know it was expired. I thought it was invalid. And I just sit there like, well, you just by your own admissions. And sometimes when people talk in court, they come in with this mindset that they're totally innocent.
Yeah.
And then they come into court and they get sworn in, and now it's the real deal. Because you're sitting in front of me, a judge, and I'm looking right at you in the eyes. And I'm watching you, mm-hmm. and maybe the light bulb comes on, mm-hmm. and the truth starts kind of coming out in a roundabout way. Sometimes folks tell the truth, they just don't tell all the truth,
right.
and I got to pick it out of them.
Yeah.
And so I will take a look, you know, and it involves everything. It involves the attire, your mannerisms, and obviously what you say.
Yes.
So in instances like that, oh, those are tough ones. Well, I didn't do it. Yes, you did. And we have a conversation, and usually there's a little bit of trip up, and then we'll go back. Can you tell the same story twice?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And if you're telling right. the truth, guess what? It's you almost can. Verbatim.
Right.
And you know, it plays itself out. Mm-hmm. Usually it plays itself out. I'd say 99.9% of the time it plays itself out in favor of the person that's telling the truth. Mm-hmm. And therein goes the no-fault insurance, too.
Now, what you just heard is the gavel hitting the table.
Oh, yeah. I was putting my fist down.
So, you know, we want to talk a little bit about Ridgely. What is attractive to for you about Ridgely and how you're governing these circumstances that come up? Because this is everyday life. This is, and this is one of the reasons why we are having this conversation, because we want the younger people to know there are laws to go by. There are rules that you have to follow. It doesn't matter whether or not you're right or wrong. There are rules that you have to live by. And because we are in a civilized society, it's important that you learn that early on so that you don't get caught up into a system that we know you're not going to like.
Well said, Kevin. Ridgely's like any other small town America. Some may think they're 10, 15 years behind times. Hey, you can think what you want.
Mm-hmm.
They've got good fundamental values.
Mm-hmm.
We are living in one of the best countries in the world.
Yes.
Trust me, I've traveled the world when I was a DEA agent. I've been overseas quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to lose focus of that. And the rule of law is the governing part. You abide by the law, you abide by the rules, you'll live a wonderful life. It's not hard to do. And again, I said earlier, people make mistakes. It's the amount of mistakes you made. If you make the same mistake over and over, then we got an issue.
Mm-hmm.
But Ridgely is trying to grow like any other small town. They're trying to get a new city building, which I hope they're successful with that. They try to hire the best employees under the circumstances. I mean, the economy's tough all around.
Mm-hmm.
But their moral compass tends to be pointed in the right direction, and that's the vast majority of the folks. Now, Ridgely encompasses Carpendale as well. They only have a couple police officers. They do a very good job under the circumstances. The state police will come in. They'll patrol. The county does a wonderful job. It's a great team that they do work together for the citizens of the community. I live a little further away. I live in a city called Fort Aspyr.
Yes.
The section of the county. It's a little bit more suburban.
Mm-hmm.
Ridgely's a little more tight like Kaiser.
Mm-hmm.
And you tend to see people on a daily basis. And what I like is I'll drive through and you'll see people sitting on the front porch.
Yes.
You know, people can still walk around, feel cool and comfortable. I'm not sure you would got that in D.C.
Mm.
I grew up in Pittsburgh. It's changed up there in some respects. Yes. I lived in Prince William County, Virginia. I heard it's changing down there. But Ridgely's got what a lot of people want. These small town Americas, people tend to gravitate to these places nowadays. But it's a good old place. I think you're treated quite fairly and firmly at times. Mm-hmm. And I enjoy working there. It's nice. I see some progress, but you can only do so much. The economy, the dollars,
yes.
They can only go so far.
Right.
But they're trying.
Yes, I agree with you that when I first came to Cumberland, which is not much bigger than Ridgely, but I would look at Ridgely and think that it was a small town that I didn't want any parts of, just because I didn't know anything about it, and I was basing that on just, nothing really, no factual basis for it. But having living there now, I recognize and realize that it does, it offers and affords you, it feels like you're in a place by yourself, like in the countryside, just away from everything, but then you can get back to everything if you choose to do so. But when we went before the judge, when we went into there in this little building, some people would be like, oh, you know, nothing's going to be real that's happening in here. But you go in and you see a real judge, you see real people who are professional,
right. Yes.
Who are doing their jobs according to the law, and it's wonderful. So my impression was even broadened just by this experience that Kevin and I had when he got that ticket. But, Ridgely offers a lot. And there's a lot of professionals here, and people doing some great things. So it's a great place to live.
Well, we're going to take a break. We're going to come back, and I have an important question that the judge can give his opinion on about where we're going now and here in the 21st century in America. We'll be right back. KingScottRadioTV.com.
We are back. And again, we are with Judge Tom Golden out of the city of Ridgely, West Virginia. We just took a little break and we just want to talk some more about some of the things that are being done here in the community. So this is the Community Beat at my father's table with Kevin T. Scott and Carrie Scott. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Well, one of the things we were just talking about off the air is what we see our millennial kids, and they're not kids, we understand they're adults, but they'll always will be our kids. And we want to inquire about how the judge looks at these kind of cases that are coming up. We spoke about the Floyd incident and all of the facts of how a person lost their life because of lack of cooperation. One thing I would like to note, the police, the judges, have an authority that's been given to them. How they got it, through education, training, but they have the authority, and we have to respect that. And if you don't respect it, you run into situations like a Floyd or other situations. That's not to say that all police enforcement are correct in some of their thinking, because everyone falls short. But there's an authority that has to be looked at, analyzed, and kept in place. If not, we would be like a third world country in a war zone. Judge, you can take it over from that.
Well, I think you made some great points there, Kevin. And what I've seen in my law enforcement career and being on the bench is, and we spoke to this, is this humbleness, this lack of humbleness or this growing disrespect amongst the millennials. And I think it surfaces predominantly through your social medias, your reality TVs that tend to almost kind of raise some of these kids. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that they are young adults, because mm-hmm. I'll get the lingo in court. They'll talk like some of these TV shows, and I've seen them. I try to educate myself. I try to see the whole picture. But if there was this element of humbleness, and I always resort back, there's a saying on the Law Enforcement Memorial in Washington, in D.C., in valor there is hope. And sometimes I'll go to schools, and I'll see these kids that are just absolutely on their game, and they're respectful, they're mindful. I'm like, wow, there's hope. But I tend to deal with the other side, particularly in law enforcement when I was chief, when I was a DEA agent. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not dealing with some of the nicest folks that have been brought to this great earth. And you try to educate them. You try to instill a little sense of humbleness, you know, wake up, do this, do that. But in court, particularly, it's so important. Like, that's the end game.
Yes.
That's the final decision. That's the fourth quarter. That's the two-minute warning. And if you're going to come in there with an attitude, or you're going to come in there ill-prepared or disrespectful, the outcome's not going to be very good for you. And then you're going to carry that on throughout your life, and it's not going to get anywhere but down.
Yes.
Now, with that, let's talk about the parenting, because it starts somewhere, this entitlement that I should have it just because mama gave it to me, or daddy gave it to me, or auntie gave it to me. They feel that they don't have to work for it. Now, that's not to say that you shouldn't give your kids good things, because you should. That's what the generations are about moving forward. But there seems to be a different element when you are looking at a Facebook or a Twitter or someone who just comes in and says, well, I deserve this. You deserve what if you didn't work for it? How would you look at that?
That's a great point. I would remind parents to monitor the comings and goings of their kids in spite of their age. And the comings and goings may not necessarily be physical. The internet, the TV, there is so much garbage in, and obviously it's garbage out.
Yes.
And, you know, at some point in time, it may take some tough love. You know, you have to set that parameter, or maybe have that agreement or that contract or whatnot. I mean, there's some fancy words in today's society on upbringing kids. There was no time out when I was a kid. It was time's up. And you know how that went down. My dad was a great guy, but he instilled in us respect, and we respected him as well as my mother. But today's kids, you know, they tend to be a little bit raised by the internet, by social media. Sometimes I go into these schools when I was chief. I walk around, I see a lot of videos being played. I don't see a lot of back and forth communication. It seems to be one-sided. And, you know, you want these kids to have this culture of development, but there's so many things being thrown at them nowadays, too.
Yes, that's true.
I think we lost sight of history. It seems now we're teaching history from the 1980s on, and I think some of our educational outlets are taking shortcuts. You know, we have all these subjects. I don't even recognize some of them, you know, that are here to these kids. I mean, what, reading, writing, and arithmetic? Now, I may sound old school. I'm in my 60s. But I can relate to the youth. I mean, you know, I'm not that old. And you know, I want to be out there with my granddaughter. I want to be involved. But sometimes I'll go, and I'm like, why are we teaching these kids,
you know,
check cashing for singles or you know, something like that, when, in fact, it should be more of a substantive type learning event, and it does start with parenting.
So one of the myths I want to clear up, when we see these YouTube shows, and this is not to say YouTube doesn't offer some good things, because if you look at it, there's some really good things you can learn off of YouTube, but some of these shows, you don't have to show the officer your ID, and I'm standing on this sidewalk, and so I want to talk about that simply because that'll get you hurt and killed.
You know, that's another great point, and it's a good launch off for a conversation. I've seen many instances where the occupant of the vehicle or the person on the street refuses to give identification. Well, first of all, you have to. It's a lawful order by a trained and lawful police officer in the state of West Virginia.
Yes.
YouTube shows a lot, and you're right, YouTube has a lot of good stuff too as well. However, I see a lot of people on the side of the street, if they would just comply, cooperate, they'll be on their way within 3-4 minutes. And no ticket, no warning, nothing will happen. But I see so many people turn a situation into a misdemeanor, and then you turn that misdemeanor perhaps into a felony, when it all could have been taken care of.
I don't want to I don't want to show you my ID. My mother said I didn't have to do anything. You hear that, right?
Oh, I hear that occasionally, and it.
Who are you to tell me anything about anything? You don't know the law. You're just sitting here trying to hassle me.
Exactly. And you targeted me, and you don't like the way I've dressed or whatnot. And quite frankly, I could care less. I don't know who you are. Usually when I do a traffic stop or when I was doing traffic stops, and the chief of Ridgely, Mark Yonker, great guy, we were talking about this morning. We don't know who we're stopping. 95% of the time, we don't know if you're young, you're old, you're white, you're black, Hispanic, whatever. We come up to the vehicle, let's have that professional conversation. You'll be surprised how things will end up.
Now, from a woman's point of view, Pastor Carrie, can you're a woman, you know what you all are capable of. And a police officer comes up and he's asking for your identification. Do you flirt with him?
Not me. You know, I guess some women would use some that. But why would they? I would never do that because they may not think, you may think you're attractive. They may not. They just may not be into that. So it's a slap in the face for them, and it makes you look dumb and stupid. So, no, I would never do that. I never try to.
But this goes on.
Yeah, it does. It's unfortunate that. And I see this, and it goes back to the Facebook and the YouTube and all that, where women especially will use their looks or their bodies to try to get someone interested in them. And it's like, really, you know, anybody who falls for that, you wouldn't want them, would you really? But I guess some would. But no, I would never be one, and I never, you know, with my daughter, no. When they stop you, sit there, and prayerfully they are on the up and up. You're expecting that they're going to be professional with you as you are sitting there waiting to go with whatever it is that he's stopping about, and to cooperate. So no, you got to cooperate. I don't care
now,
what you look like.
We also see, because we examine Facebook, because being pastors, we have to know what's going on in the world. Not that we want to play the games that the world will play, but we see women, we see men exposing their bodies, just
too much,
blatant, just bent over. And in some cases with the men, they got all their muscles out and they put it on for the world to see. But for the ladies, it's somewhat appalling to see some of the things that we see. Have you had to deal, Judge, with any prostitutes or prostitution or some of the things that I learned when I came here? And I've only been here 2 years. You see the bars that have precarious people hanging around, hanging out, and you know not to go over there. My wife told me you better not ever go over there, but you know it's there. How do you view that?
You know, coming from D.C., we saw a lot of that. In my days in Miami, I actually worked on a prostitution sting as a DEA agent. And that was very interesting. It was a weed and seed program. But up here...
Weed and seed?
Weed and seed is a government program. At the time, I was assigned to West Palm Beach. You kind of pick the weeds, which was the bad elements of the community. You pick them out, which meant you arrested those that were involved in those types of activities. And then you seeded. You turned it into a playground. Or you seized that house that was a drug dealer house. And that's why the federal agencies were involved, because we could take it federally. And we had a really active and robust asset forfeiture seizure program that the state locals, they could do, they easily could do, but we had a little bit more leverage on the federal level, so I was involved in that task force. But up here, Ridgely, I really haven't come across much of it. There was a touch of it in Kaiser, but we were pretty aggressive. As a chief, I wanted my guys and gals out there on the street. I wanted them visible. I wanted them proactive. And yeah, there were times I wanted them to be aggressive, and that minimized some of the things that you just talked about, the possibility for that to even flourish or even initiate itself, prostitution, whatnot. It goes synonymous with drugs, though, I will tell you, and we all know that. I mean, you got prostitution, you got drugs. It's, right. It's no ifs, ands, and buts. But I don't see much of that up here. There are some seedy places. There's a few. There's one in Ridgely. There's a couple in Kaiser.
Yes.
You know, they try to enforce appropriately. You know, you got to protect people's freedom of speech and freedom of this and freedom of that. So there's a line, though, and every now and then the line's crossed, but by and large, it seems to be under control.
I know the drugs. Some of the people, my wife sees people, babies with no hats on their head.
Yeah, you know, it just goes back to, again, us parenting and just how you are, you know, so responsible for things that your children get into, from making sure that they are properly fed and sheltered, right, and, you know, clothed, all of those things, which can then lead into what they're watching on social media, just all of that. We have to be involved so that, right, things can happen. So, yeah, so I have this ministry, and, you know, Kevin has brought it up, and, you know, just talk a little bit about it real quickly, but I see mothers out there, or fathers, sometimes preaching their children as children are walking. I saw one yesterday, and I wasn't prepared. It was colder yesterday morning, and the little person was walking. They had a coat on. The person, little girl, had on boots, but her legs were not covered because she had a dress on. The wind was blowing. Her little hair was blowing. It was cold. She had nothing on her head, but the mother had a hat on her head. And I was like, oh, my gosh, this child needs a hat. Don't you realize you got a hat? Child needs a hat. But anyway, that's just a little bit of something what I do. This
do you ever feel threatened when you go up to people, Pastor, mm-mm, and offer them a hat? Because you've done this, and sometimes I'm a little nervous about it because you don't know what mind frame people are in, and sometimes you just want to stay in your lane. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, I know the Spirit leads you. Mm-hmm. But do you ever feel, oh, you know, that person looks a little too out of it for me to approach them when you see kids like that?
No, I don't. If I'm led to approach, I just approach it gently, and if they refuse, I'll be prepared for that. I've always said that I'll be prepared either way, and just do that. But I'm there to do what I need to do. I mean, kind of like police officer, you do what you need to do. But with this situation, no. And I've, all the times that I've done it, everybody has been very receiving, and so I'm going to continue to do it. In fact, I've got to go and get my things together so that I can have it in my car. But no, I'm not going to go and see something and not do something about it. If I see a child who looks like they need it, or even adults and whatever, I will do that. So I don't feel threatened.
That's good to hear. God's probably provided you with the necessary armament.
Right.
Yeah,
unfortunately, absolutely, with us, and when I was chief, and nowadays, these officers carry so much, yes, equipment and their ballistic vests, and it's nice to hear that. You don't have that fear, and obviously, mm-hmm, you know, you're blessed, and you're doing God's work, and,
yeah,
and that's cool. It takes that type of effort to really evolve a community from good to great.
Yeah, and I, you know, that's small compared, I think, to what you guys do. But again, it's large in another sense, and so, you know, we each have to do our part, and I like that. Mm-hmm. But can I just go back to something, mm-hmm, Chief, that I heard you say earlier in profiling? Sometimes when you're making a traffic stop, you don't know whether the person in there is black or white or old or young or whatever, and I like to hear that, because it's good to hear from the judge, who was a police officer and so involved with so many aspects of the law, that you're not doing racial profiling. So often we hear there's racial profiling, and here in Cumberland and West Virginia, Ridgely, the small place, it's good to know that there's none of that coming from your office that you manage.
You know, I'm glad you brought that up. When I was a DEA agent, and I was assigned to the office training in Quantico, Virginia, we were part of that study nationwide. I think Janet Reno was the attorney general at the time, and mm-hmm, that was a hot topic.
Mm-hmm.
And we go through a lot of training with respects to that. And just from a personal standpoint, when I do the traffic stop, or when I was doing them, I really didn't know in most instances. Now, I could see the body from behind, and I could tell the dispatch is occupied two times. But when I would get up to the vehicle, then I would discover who exactly they were, mm-hmm, and, you know, what ethnicity or whatnot. But it never mattered. I cut brakes, or I wrote tickets, no matter, you know, what the situation, right, was. So they have really, really done some incredible training in that respect. So now this cultural diversity training that's big nowadays, mm-hmm, too. So, you know, law enforcement tries to stay ahead of the curve.
Yes.
Unfortunately, you know, you look at the New York City Police Department. There's like 40,000 sworn officers, roughly. You know, 40,000 people, you're going to get some idiots.
Absolutely.
And you know, I've worked with some in my tenure, you know, both with DEA and task force, but far and few between, though. And I'm glad you brought that up, because guys are really trying to do their darndest out there to uphold the laws that they're entitled to enforce,
yeah,
and have positive outcomes and a positive experience for everyone involved. I mean, we're all in this together.
Absolutely.
So, one of the things I would ask with the type of experience that you have, what makes an officer have to pull his gun out? Because at that point, it's critical.
Well, I'll tell you, I just took a deep breath when you said that, because I reflect back. I was in a shooting in Miami, and your trained levels of lethal force are less than lethal. And, you know, it all starts out with your uniform presence. If that doesn't calm the situation, you can resort to perhaps an ass baton, which is, you know, a baton maybe you can strike on the elbows, or you can use pepper spray, or you can use the taser. If none of that works and it doesn't control the situation and you feel that your life is in jeopardy and the jeopardy of life surrounds you, then you can resort to that lethal force, you know, force necessary to neutralize the situation. And those are some incredibly tough days, and it lives with you forever. Trust me, whether it's a good shoot, and unfortunately maybe there's a bad shoot, no officer wants to go through that. Nobody does. And you feel for the victims' families. But again, it comes back to that simple compliance. But when drugs are involved, and you got meth in this particular region, and you got other drugs involved in the situation, people pull tasers off. I've been tased in order to carry the tase. It is pain on steroids. You will comply. Pepper spray lasts a little longer. I don't like pepper spray. I think the worst of it, I probably wouldn't want to be pepper spray because the taser goes away. But when you tase somebody and they pull the prongs out, you got yourself a situation that's going to be extremely difficult to control. And unfortunately, it plays out on television like...
It's nothing, Dave.
Look at the totality of the situation. Usually you're going to see about 8 officers and 1 defendant, but you weren't there when the defendant was whooping the officer and the officer's calling for backup, and the defendant has total disrespect for the uniform. So
disrespect for the uniform, I want the public to know the person inside the uniform is human just like you.
Yes.
But you have to respect the authority of the uniform. And if you can stay in that mindset, in that lane, you can live. If you step outside of that, you put yourself in danger because the law is going to fall a certain way so we don't have a third world society that we're living in. Some places you go and you will travel, you see things that you would never thought you would see.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. Some of my world travels, I've been to Haiti several times. I've been down there on the job, throughout Central Asia, the Middle East. There are some tough situations, and I'll come back home and I get off that airplane and I'm a McDonald's freak. I hate to say this, but I'll get myself a Big Mac and I'll drive home.
Comforting food, yeah.
And I'm glad to be back in the United States of America, but we need to sustain and maintain this country's ability to be that powerful that it is, and in that law-abiding country too as well.
So in an officer having to pull his weapon out, that I know that's such a tense thing, but they're only looking at it. I think society only looks at it from one side. They're saying, oh, he pulled his gun out. Why did he pull his gun out? That's
critical. I do that just in lay people when they come and they want to shoot. And I'm not a big gun guy. I'm not into that. If I got to use it, I'll use it. But it's so important. Why? You know, there's a lot of people, and again, getting off of law enforcement, they can shoot great, and they're like, oh, well, you know, if an intruder comes into my house, you know, blah, 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 blah. You better know your why. Why did you do that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and in law enforcement, there is so much training involved with lethal force that I am confident when I was chief, any officer that came out of the West Virginia State Police Academy was very well trained in all aspects of the job, specifically lethal force, cultural diversity, the racial profiling stuff. They train on that dozens and dozens of hours. And you just put them in situations. And I held my guys to a high degree of proficiency and professionalism. I took it personal. If somebody came in and complained about one of the officers, my thing was you put it in writing, I'll look into it. Now, obviously, people were upset that they got a ticket, or maybe the officer didn't talk to them the way they felt they should. And, you know, I can decipher that and filter through that.
Yeah.
But if it was legit, if there was something that the officer, immediately, we're going to have a sit down. We might have a suspension. We might have a dismissal.
Yeah.
But I'm going to look into that.
That's great. That's good to hear. You know, thinking about the situation that's happening in some of the major cities, especially one that's closer to where we are, Washington, D.C., as we all know, the crime rate is just really crazy out of hand. And they're trying to figure out what they should do about that. I think it would be really great. This is just my thought and my idea. That sometimes those from a smaller community, like a Ridgely, like a Cumberland, who, like you were saying, that in the situation in Kaiser, there was a little bit of the prostitution that Kevin was talking about, how you nipped it. You did something about it so that it didn't infiltrate and get bigger. And maybe there's something that, you know, those from a smaller town where there's not an issue with that, or where there was an evidence that it was trying to infiltrate what you did, that could be open for a discussion to help them out, because they seem to not know what they need to do. And, you know, nothing is tried and true and perfect, but at the same time, I think that coming together to talk about those issues is great.
One of the things, I know the public is listening to this conversation particularly, let's talk about the bad officer. I don't want the show to represent a perfect law enforcement. Everyone's making the right decision. Can you tell us, when you know that there's a bad officer that's doing bad things? Because we think that that doesn't happen, but it does.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I tell you, each department, and most of the ones up here are very small, so they don't have their specific internal affairs. That'll probably go to the state. Now, coming from the federal side, we had officer professional responsibility. They were very aggressive. And nothing upsetted me more. I mean, I know the general public gets upset when a bad officer is discovered and, you know, there's a trial and whatnot. It upsets us even that much more, because we all kind of get painted with the same brush.
Mm-hmm.
And there is no room, absolutely no room for a bad officer. Now, there may be a general mistake in paperwork or something like that, or, you know, maybe in a traffic stop, but if it gets physical and there's any type of physicality that is unnecessary, oh, I'm all in. You know, let's bring him before the judges and, mm-hmm. and rule accordingly. So it really does bug me. What we're seeing today is, you know, there are a few. There's too many, actually. But
mm-hmm.
I think the training and the punishment is really a huge deterrent with respects to these guys and
yes.
gals. And, yeah, there's a little too many out there, and I think the numbers are starting to dwindle a little bit. But
mm-hmm.
when you got 250,000 police officers
yes.
across these United States, and the way the country's going in some respects, it's frustrating, and tempers do become short. But I hold it, and I still will hold all law enforcement, no matter who they are, to the highest degree. Because, you know, you're taking that oath, and you have a
yes.
lot of authority. You have a lot
yes.
of power.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, I'm the type of guy, I'll stop and help somebody change their tire on the side of the road. They'll be shocked that that does happen. When
yes.
I was chief, I would do that.
Yes.
But that's what I signed up for, to
yeah.
help. It
right.
may sound a little corny, but to serve and protect.
No, not at all.
I took that extremely seriously. But there are entities, and thankfully there are, internal affairs, Office of Professional Responsibility, that will investigate these types of incidents very thoroughly and come to positive conclusions.
Well, we're at that time where we're just going to give you an opportunity to talk about your staff, give a shout out to your office, family, and things like that, because you have a wife, and I don't want her thinking, because I have a wife, and I know I always want to definitely lift her up in anything that I do, because it's always a team effort. So
yeah.
this is your time to talk about your office and your family and things like that.
Well, first of all, I thank you guys for giving me the opportunity.
Thank
you.
You
know, it's interesting how things turn out, and that's why I am very engaging in the system, and, you know, like this particular instance. But my wife's a retired ATF agent. She was part of their internal affairs. She was in charge of their internal affairs, the Office of Professional Responsibility. I would not want her investigating me. She is extraordinarily thorough, and she holds people accountable.
Mm-hmm.
Got my granddaughter, my daughter, my son. My son's a former Marine. Great Corps there. I got a large family. The police officers throughout this county, from the sheriff to the police chief in Kaiser, that's, you know, Chief Jared, they do a wonderful job. The chief in Ridgely, you got the college. I think everybody's in a good place with respect to teamwork. We do have challenges. And you know, the drug situation, it seems to me that most crime, 90% in Kaiser, was directly or indirectly related to drugs and drug usage.
Wow.
I told them when I was chief, here comes fentanyl. It's a train coming down the tracks. It's coming in Pittsburgh, New York, Philly, coming up from the south, and we better be prepared. Mm-hmm. And I took some initiatives to where we have some federal manpower, and I won't get into the specifics, but there's some pretty good players in place to kind of engage. You know, fentanyl, you get a little package of sugar, that's a gram. A milligram can kill a person. So you get a gram of that sugar, and just imagine that you're out, you know, at the restaurant, shake one of those grams, that can kill probably about 100, 200 people. And that's becoming prevalent, and that's the opioid, and that's the heroin situation. So those are things you want, you definitely want to educate yourself with and educate the people around you. But this is a great place up here. You know, we got to take initiatives, be a little bit aggressive. You know, if you see something, say something. I get all that. But take accountability for your own reactions and actions. I can't stress that enough when people come to court. You know, if you're wrong, you're wrong. Mm-hmm. And if you're right, you're right.
Yes.
And use common sense. And you will leave a happy person, and you'll be able to do whatever you want to do. And, you know, maybe not ever get... make contact with law enforcement, but if you do, you know, we spoke about it, and again, I can't thank things like this enough, so we can have that communication. I'm a big fan of Stephen Covey's 7 Habits for Highly Effective People, and one of my favorites is understand and be understood. You know, listen to people, think win-win. You know, do things of that nature. Have a roadmap for your life, and you'll be successful. You don't have to go to college, go to trade school, do something, military. Just do something, lean into it, be productive, challenge yourself a little bit. Mm-hmm. We all have it in it, us. But again, I think this is wonderful that you have this outreach, and you know, you're even doing things on the streets of Cumberland. You know, Cumberland's an interesting city all in itself. I see some growth here. It looks cool. I come up here for some of the restaurants, and I interact with the police department occasionally, and you know, we're all in this together.
Yes.
So, Pastor Kerry, we always want to give you an opportunity to give shout-outs as well. Whenever we're on the air, we don't take it lightly that we have this tool to serve humanity. Is there any last things that you would like to say while we're closing out?
Again, just to reiterate that we are all in this together. And for every person who's listening, to just recognize and realize that we each have a part to play and how we treat our police department and our officers within the city, our officials, as they have a you know, understanding about how they're supposed to treat the public, and that's all of us, and how we want to be treated, we should treat someone else the same way, and treat them with kindness, and you know, listen, like the judge just said, listen to be listened to and understood. If we can all come to an understanding, I think it would be great. So, yes.
Well, the last thing I would want to say is that we're going to keep doing shows like this. We also play some terrific jazz. We play rock. We play a little of everything. And we want to broaden our horizons. Whatever God wants us to do,
we'll do it. One thing I'd like to say, Kevin, before we get off the air is, again, we found out just this morning that Judge plays the saxophone. So maybe the next time, a self-taught saxophonist.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
So maybe the next time we'll have him play a little bit of something for us. And it's inspired me because I used to be a trumpeter. So I may get my trumpet out and see what I can do. But it's probably going to take a lot of practice for that.
Well, that Judge Tom Golden, we're going to let you have the absolute last word, and just tell us what you, the last point that you want to make to the community beat and how we can be better citizens so that make your job easier in judging our habits and some of the things that we do.
Thank you very much. Unfortunately, I would prefer to do a little more fishing, as I mentioned earlier. So with that said, I mean, obviously, if people would abide by the rule of law, you know, we wouldn't have to do the things we do, and you wouldn't see some of the horrific events you would see on TV. We need to protect the Constitution that our forefathers written for us. It's not outdated, and let's educate ourselves a little bit more on those particular items. And like Kerry said, yeah, we are all in this together. No matter where you come from, where you've been, or even where you're going, do it with pride, be humble, be a good citizen of these United States. We all got kids, grandkids. Let's leave it a little better than what we had.
Yes, absolutely.
And that's kind of the way I look at it. And again, if you're coming into court, you know, just own it and be honest, be professional. And I think the outcome you'll see will be very productive for you, and you'll like what you see. But I had a great opportunity here with you guys today. I look forward to seeing you guys grow and see you around the communities and see you on the streets of Ridgely, and maybe not back in court. That'd be a
short time
with
me.
Yeah, there we go. But thanks again, and have a wonderful afternoon, and let's get ready for the holidays in the spirit of the Jesus.
Yes. Amen. This has been another production by King Scott Radio TV. Kevin and Kerry Scott. Pastors, we're leading the way for Jesus. Amen.
Amen.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you, Judge.